Welcome back to Augusta Free Press on Facebook. I'm Chris Graham, joined by Crystal Graham. I feel like I've lived today on Facebook and Facebook Live on Augusta Free Press today, Crystal. But we are here this evening for our discussion of Inman Major's book, The Millionaires. Crystal has a card copy as well downstairs. And I picked this book up. Crystal, you've done book clubs for a long time, and you led a discussion a few weeks ago here on Augusta Free Press on Facebook. This is my first book club. I'm excited to be a part of this. Inman Majors is a friend of ours. We've known Inman and his family for a long time. And I guess I have to mention a couple things, if it's okay, Crystal, before we start. Inman is someone, again, I mentioned we've known for a while. He and his wife, Christy, blessed us last spring, allowing us to serve in a mentorship role with their oldest child, their daughter, Tess, who was a senior at the time at St. Anne's Belfield School in Charlottesville. Tess was a joy, a wonderful student to be around. I learned a lot from her, as much as she probably learned from us. In the 6 weeks, I think she was with us last April, May into early June. And she was then a freshman at Barnard College in New York City, and tragically had her life cut short. She was murdered in December. And so I bring that up to say that, first, our condolences continue for the Majors family. And then today, just obviously coincidental to the fact that we chose this day to be the day we discussed a book by Inman Majors. There was a plea in the case. One of the young men accused of their roles in the murder pleaded guilty today in New York City. And then also, no more bad news for the Majors family. Inman's uncle, Johnny Majors, celebrated College Hall of Fame football coach, won a national title as the head coach at the University of Pittsburgh, Pitt, as we call it, and then went back to his alma mater, Tennessee, where he was a star football player and then became the head coach, won 3 SEC titles in 16 seasons before retiring from Tennessee. Johnny Majors passed away this morning at the age of 85. So had to mention those two bits of news, Crystal, just because, we're getting ready to discuss a book by Inman Majors, someone we know well and love as a writer. And then those two news bits kind of bit today.
So, Chris, you started to answer this question. As you said, you haven't led a book club before. I was kind of going to throw you into the fire and let you lead this one. I've been a part of a book club in the greater Augusta area for a little while, and we usually just pick a title. We usually banter around about a few titles and then select one. And in this case, this was your selection. So, other than obviously knowing the author and his family and having had their daughter or his daughter as an intern here, you had read this book, The Millionaires, some time ago. And you said when we were picking our next title that you wanted this to be the one. And I know you read it again, but why did you feel so passionately, putting aside, of course, what happened to Tess? Why did you feel so passionately that this was a good title for folks to be reading?
Well, one, I thought just in general, it would be a great opportunity to expose our reader base to Inman Majors. I think people, when we read things, we read things off bestseller lists. We read things for lots of reasons. And we can often tend to overlook great writers who live in our midst. I mean, Inman used to live in Waynesboro. He and his family, including Tess, used to live in Waynesboro, lived here for several years. That's how we got to know the family. And now they live all the way over in Charlottesville. Inman teaches at JMU, lives in Charlottesville. And so I thought it would be a great opportunity just in general to expose our reader base to a great local author. I've read two of his books, and you've got a pile of books actually, Crystal, on your desk, other books by Inman that we've purchased and are going to read over the summer. I know I'm going to read them all over the summer. I've already started a third book, but the two that I've read, The Millionaires, and there's another one, Love's Winning Place. Right there. Yeah, you knew where I was going, right?
I did know where you're going. I haven't read this other one yet. I'm looking forward to it.
It is, okay, so The Millionaires is 478 pages. Love's Winning Plays is in the 250 range. If I was picking just for brevity, I would have obviously gone with the with Love Is When He Plays. And that's a book that is more of a, it's a sports book. I mean, I don't say sports book. It's not, it's a novel. The setting is in a sports setting, a football coach setting. It's a good novel. I mean, it's just, but it happens that the protagonist and the main, you know, story is in football, college football. I chose The Millionaires because it is set in Southern politics. And, you know, I felt like it would carry more weight if it was about politics and about sports. And knowing Inman and then knowing him as an author too, and you start to get to know the man. Inman majors, you know, he teaches creative writing and literature at JMU, as I mentioned. I like everyone. I mean, I'm a quasi author, I guess. I've written a few books, nothing that's gotten read like Inman's books, or John Grisham, another local author who happens to be a national and international author, known author. But you write what you know, right? So in Inman's case, there's two strains to the family background that would lead him to write what he writes. The football, I mentioned Johnny Majors, his uncle was a star football player at the University of Tennessee, then became a college football Hall of Fame level coach at Pitt in Tennessee. And then Loves When He Plays dives into that side of Inman's background. The Millionaires plays to the other side. Inman's father was a lobbyist in Tennessee politics for over 40 years. And so if you're a young Inman growing up in the Majors household, you've got your uncle is a big time college football coach. For those out there who are watching a book, who are part of this book club and don't know college football that well to know what when I say he's a big time college football coach, the University of Tennessee plays football games in a stadium that has 110,000 seats. And it's sold out every Saturday in the fall that it has games. And the Tennessee hasn't been that good in recent years. It's still sold out. And everybody's wearing that particular shade of orange in that stadium. So big deal. And then Tennessee politics, another big deal. So this book, The Millionaires, plays into, again, it tells the story of Tennessee politics and Southern politics from the perspective of someone who grew up in Southern politics because his father was a lobbyist. I think it's a really, that background, I think, tells you a lot about where this book can take you.
So I want to invite people who may be tuning in right now to have a conversation with us throughout this Facebook Live. The idea behind this, of course, was that you would read the book and have a discussion with us. I couldn't get anyone else on the Zoom with us tonight, Chris, but the idea is that you can, of course, weigh in through comments, and I'll be monitoring these throughout our discussion this evening. So you mentioned, of course, Tennessee politics. One thing I didn't know until I actually finished the book, which is really interesting because I hadn't read anything about this. This book was written in 2010. It's been called that it's kind of a Southern Great Gatsby. The title, the cover actually says that. But I didn't know that a lot of this was kind of fiction, but based around something that had actually happened in Tennessee. So in Tennessee, apparently there was a big effort for a World Fair. In our book, we talk about the Cole brothers, but in real life, it was the Butcher brothers. And there was a crooked state senator involved, also happened in the book. And so really, in a sense, this was the retelling of the 1982, I learned after I finished the book, Knoxville World's Fair. So, and those, the Butcher brothers actually ended up going to jail as well for some fraud, went to prison for fraud. They were bankers. That is what this book is in a nutshell. But of course, there was a lot of fiction written around it, a lot of fleshing it out. Did you know that before you read the book, Chris, or are you like me that you read this after the fact?
I knew the stories. I knew the World's Fair I knew happened because I remember being a kid and hearing about the World's Fair coming to Knoxville. And I'm sure the people who reacted in the book, the folks in the book, why would Knoxville get a World's Fair? I mean, I was only 10 years old and I even knew what's Knoxville getting a World's Fair for. So I didn't know the story of the brothers. I guess what this book does so well, I don't want to cast this word. I've been a journalist covering politics for 25 years. So I don't want to tell you that I'm not telling you anything that I know about how things are done crooked in politics, but you know, for things to happen, often things have to happen to make them happen that are a little shady, a little controversial. And so, no, I love, you know, when you tell a story in a journalistic way, you've got to be careful, right? You got to have your I's dotted and your T's crossed. When you go into the fictional realm, you can do some things detail wise that can flesh some things out, good and bad. I mean, obviously, the way the characters are developed in this book, you get to know the Coles, JT and Roland Cole. Yeah, you get to know the Coles in a way that, again, a journalist would have a hard time doing, because, you know, Inman takes us back to when they were children. They were 2 years apart in age. They grew up, I wouldn't say poor. They grew up though humble. I mean, with a father and mother who were teen parents who had a small farm, grew their own food, you know, very humble. Then the father actually helped participate in starting a local, if you call it a bank, it almost sounds too big, almost like a thrift, that the sons then took into being a lot more than that. And that was the basis of how they injected themselves into Tennessee politics.
So, yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that I really loved about the book, and I want to talk to you a little bit about it because you've read some of his other books as well. One of the things I loved, though, was the fact that we got to know the characters so well. So, as you said, the Cole brothers, we basically had Roland, the younger brother, who was running for governor, and his older brother, JT, who I think kind of felt like he was second fiddle to his brother most of the time. And, you know, in the story, you know, Roland builds a bank and JT gets a bank, but it's a little bit bigger than the brothers, and they're both skyscrapers for their communities, so to speak. But one of the things that you talk about is a little bit about how they were new money. Both of them, as they were working to make names for themselves, were working to become governor. When that failed, they went into trying to bring this World's Fair to the fictional town of Glenville, which was a small town and seemed very unlikely to happen. They introduced another character named Mike Teague, who was kind of their consultant, you might say, their political consultant. He was the one, like you said, the relative of the author, Inman Majors, who his father, I think you said, who kind of worked as a lobbyist, but he was the one who had the political inside knowledge and the connections. And eventually the three of them were able to get this fair to this fictional town of Glenville. But what we learned along the way was that they basically robbed Peter to pay Paul, and they were transferring money back and forth between different banks and things of that nature, forging signatures, doing whatever it took to get the credit for bringing the fair to the town. But in the end, they kind of figured out that perhaps they wouldn't even be remembered for the fair because there was a big scandal and all of these people were brought before the FBI and the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation as well. And as a result of that, their legacy was not perhaps what they thought it might be. You know, and I don't want to have a ton of spoilers about how the book ends, but we'll just say that it does follow very much the model, so to speak, of the real life Butcher brothers, I guess you could say.
So don't look that up before you read this book. I mean, it'll give away from it. I like, it was told, Crystal, I'll go into a little bit of the telling of it. I mean, you know, as well as, because you've given a great synopsis without giving away any spoilers. One, it seems to me, see if you agree with this, Crystal, because Inman used what I would call, I'm not a literature person, so, but I would call like sort of a roving first person narrator, because, you know, depending on the chapter and the story being told, you know, it will be told through the eyes of that particular protagonist. So it's not like there was one protagonist, it was one eye, and then everybody else was he or she. You know, often there would be a different eye between the chapters. But it felt like to me, if you boil this down to the person you were supposed to really see this story through, I would argue that was Mike Teague, the lobbyist. What is your thought on that?
I would agree with you in some ways. I mean, in the end, he was the one who probably was most hurt by the Cole brothers, even though he gave them his trust and his complete confidence and, you know, didn't spill anything that he might have known about them. until the very end. You know, he ended up walking away from it, unlike the Cole brothers who had to face this, because they ended up being honest and saying that he actually had not participated in anything. I do think that, like you, though, that it was told through Mike Teague's eyes and most of the book. They called him Teague, not really Mike Teague. So yeah. You'll hear me going back and forth between those references. But yeah, it did seem like it was being told through his eyes, even though we did see some of JT, I feel like, as well. You know, there was definitely a look into his life and the fact that he felt like I said, that he was second to his brother, that most people saw him as kind of being behind the scenes, whereas his brother was the front man. You know, they both seemed to wear the part well. You know, they could wear a good suit just like Teague could, and fit the bill of both a governor as well as a, you know, potential governor, as well as a governor, as well as a banker, a slick banker, you know, because in the town of Glenville, they were kind of seen as outsiders, even though they had made that to their hometown. So people kind of saw them as, you know, slick in a lot of ways. You know, I wanted to say we do have a comment here from a listener, and it's our good friend Rod Mullins, who you just wrapped up a podcast with on NASCAR. But he said the Butcher family, that Jake Butcher actually ran for governor for the state of Tennessee, just like in the book, our friend Roland ran for governor. And he didn't get elected, but he did have those connections that we were talking about. And that he said in his mind, the Butcher brothers rank up there with former Governor Ray Blanton for backroom deals. So there you go. So I didn't know that history. And I didn't know, of course, like I said, that this book was kind of based on something that had happened in Tennessee. So that was interesting to me. Yeah, Mike Teague, you know, in this book, kind of was the, I want to say that he was kind of someone who was drug into their world, you know, because of his connections, and he kind of stayed on maybe longer than he should.
It feels like, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I felt like he kind of got caught up in their world. And then all of a sudden, I think when he finally decided to walk away, it was one night when JT and Roland were hosting some people at JT's bank. And, you know, it was a couple of young ladies, you might say. Throughout this book, you'll find that neither of the Cole brothers and Teague himself had also been, had many mistresses, you might say, throughout their careers, throughout their lifetimes.
Because that's what we know of. And the Cole brothers, though, multiple.
Yes. And always seem to have their eye out for the next person, even though I think in both cases, and this was again a good thing that the author Inman Majors did, in my mind, he showed that they very much loved their wives. Both of them did. And just for some reason, and maybe it was this new money thing, maybe it was just the fact that they could get away with it, but they constantly had these flings with other people. I won't say that their wives were in the dark. Maybe Roland's wife, Libby, didn't know about it as much, but the book does detail how Corinne, which is the wife of JT, finds out more than once about affairs. She generally takes him back. And she does that, towards the end of the book, you know, we have another big episode where she discovers an affair and she again takes him back. So, but definitely that is highlighted throughout the book. So it kind of gives you this impression of two guys, new money, slick, you know, doing whatever it takes to get the deal done. They were obviously people who wanted to be in the public eye. They wanted people to like them. We all know politicians kind of like that, right? That want people to like them. And so as a result of that, they're having affairs, they're doing whatever it takes to get things done. Even some backhanded deals, they're, I'm sure, greasing some skids to get things done at points along the way. They're even threatening, you know, if you're not with us now, then, you know, we'll remember that, those kinds of things.
I would add a layer to that though. Sure. What I would add a layer to, I noticed this as I was reading, you know, because at first when you read a book, you're trying to figure out who everybody is. So the Cole brothers themselves, I mentioned their humble beginnings. You know, they come from a small farm, small town. They didn't go to UT. So we'll call Glenville is Knoxville. Knoxville is the home of UT. Knoxville is not a small town, but it's not a big city. It's where the World's Fair was eventually held. Like I mentioned, 110,000 people go to Tennessee football games 6 to 7 times a year. So it becomes a big city those 6 or 7 Saturdays a year. But they had a chip on their shoulder because they did not get to go to UT. They didn't go to Vanderbilt. Oh, my gosh. I mean, you know, that's like, you know, I don't even know what the equivalent is, because in Virginia, both those schools would be UVA. You know, UT and maybe it would be the difference between Virginia Tech and Virginia. They didn't get to go to either. They went to – they mentioned it at one point, and only once. They went to East Tennessee State, and they had a huge chip on their shoulder for that reason. Mike Teague went to Vanderbilt. Remember that, Crystal. Mike Teague went to Vanderbilt, but he also – he mentioned he came from a humble background. He married into money. His wife, Jan, her father had money. It was described almost as more money than God. And so so Teague was a high school teacher who married a wealthy young woman. Then he felt like, I can't be a teacher anymore because father-in-law is going to lord that over me for the rest of my life. So he became a lobbyist. So you got those three, the three main characters, the Cole brothers, you know, way out of their element. They want to do more. Teague, out of his element, wants to do more. There was another recurring character whose name escapes me, but you know, the lobbyist that Teague would meet occasionally at the state capitol.
Yeah, wasn't it? I'm trying to think, but you're right. It wasn't Bentley, but it was something
something like that. That yeah. he ran into to get reconnaissance and get information. Who himself wasn't even a guy who went to East Tennessee State. Mm-hmm. He kept mentioning he was a product of one of Tennessee's finer junior colleges. And so, yeah, the only person that was a main character sort was the current governor in the book that Teague had worked for, then left to work for the Coles.
Right.
That gentleman was someone who I want to say he went to Vanderbilt. He was not from a poor background, but he won his election the year he ran for governor mm-hmm. by portraying himself as having been poor. Right. So the one person in Tennessee politics at that time. Who came across as being the man of the people was the only one of them who wasn't a man of the people. Right. All the people who looked like the slick bankers and slick lobbyists were actually people from humble backgrounds who wanted to pretend like they were bigger than they were. So it really, the more I read that, the more I got into that, the more I thought, man, this is, it's a world of appearances. And that's the reason I like this book so much, because it kind of stripped off what you see of politics. You always see politicians in suits, you know, the ties, the great, you know, the women in the you know, the very expensive business attire, and presenting these images of themselves as being so much more than they are. And what this book does is say they put their pants on one leg at a time, like the rest of us. They're all just like the rest of us. They're trying to make a living. Now the Coles, yes, in this case, the Coles, got a little big, but I can't remember, Crystal, which brother it was who was saying this towards the end of the book, trying to explain away, you know, like why they did all the things they did. Their father did not dream that big, and they did. The brothers dreamed that big. They wanted to do more than just have a small hayseeds, a thrift bank in their small town outside of Knoxville. They wanted to have a chance to do something bigger, and you know what? They got to go to the White House. They met with the president. They put on a World's Fair. They ran for governor. They did all these things. And yes, at the end, it doesn't work out for them. But they got to do those things. And I got the feeling at the end of the book that yeah, okay, so things didn't work out for the guys, but they didn't regret it for a second.
Yeah, it was a heck of a ride. So I want to shift gears a little bit, because I want to talk a little bit about the author and about some of the choices he made throughout the book. You're an author yourself, Chris, so I'm just interested in your opinion. And of course, I'll weigh in where I can as well. But one of the things that interested me is that, so I'm going to divide the book up really into three sections. Yes. And the first section is the run for governor. The second section is the World Fair and their effort to bring that expo, so to speak, to Glenville. And then the third part of the book is really the FBI and the TBI and the investigation and what happens there. So I want to start with the beginning of the book and the governor, the fact that that Roland, the younger brother, is running for governor, JT by his side. They bring in Teague, the consultant. One of the things that really surprised me, because again, this is probably a third of the book, is how quickly we moved from running for governor to the expo. And I'll say it this way, Chris, I'm fascinated by this run for governor by Roland and everything that's happening related to that behind the scenes and everything. And then in a few sentences in like the next chapter, so to speak, it basically says, oh, Roland didn't win. And so now we're moving on. Right. And I know I went back and I read that three, you were ahead of me in the book when you were rereading it. And so we were sitting in the living room one evening and I was reading the book, and I don't think you were that particular evening, but like I said, you were way ahead of me in the book already. And I said, wait, what? He didn't win the governorship? You know what I mean? And I think I was just so surprised, because for something that took up a third of the book, the author kind of explained it away in a couple of sentences, the fact that he didn't win. Did that surprise you at all reading this? Or what did you think of an author as far as that was the way to transition to the next thing that we were moving on to, the expo, the World's Fair?
I felt like he felt, the MN felt like he didn't need to belabor the point that he lost. He had the whole third of the book, the book is basically thirds. The last third's a little shorter than the other two thirds, if that makes sense, but the book is essentially three parts. Everything he wrote about that campaign told you that he was going to lose. The only question was how much he would lose by. It's sometimes, you know, I guess Inman and I are both sports guys too. When two teams meet, sometimes on the college football field, if William and Mary's playing Virginia, you don't need to tell me that in the fourth quarter it was 52-10 and here's what happened then. Just tell me what happened afterwards. So it didn't surprise me in that sense. He spent more of the time giving you detail on politics. And I'll tell you, Crystal, one reason I really like this book, I quote some things from this book all the time in my own head, at least, if not out loud, and sometimes in my writing. One of the phrases that has stayed with me since I first read this book 10 years ago is, in politics, if you're explaining, you're losing. There are some great little kernels of Southern politics that should explain all politics. That Inman says so well in this book. And I could just imagine him as a young kid sitting in the living room, his dad coming back from a day spending time in the legislature trying to lobby governors and senators and lawmakers, and saying, son, if you're explaining, you're losing. I mean, I could see some of these things coming up. There was that really descriptive passage where they were trying to film the TV commercial for the campaign. And, you know, all the discussion of, wow, you know, what kind of, should the jeans be new, or they look like they're worn? Do we roll the cuffs up? You know, can we go borrow a truck, because this truck looks too new? We need a used looking truck, because if we're going to put a truck on a farm in a 30-second commercial, it better look like a truck that's been used on a real farm. You know,
we need to wear the right watch. He took the one off Teague instead of his own watch because his watch was too slick, and he had dog jump in the car in the truck with him. You know,
the dog had to be perfect, right? I
mean, so the right kind of dog too, right? Yeah, it had to be the right kind of dog.
Yeah, like for us, Crystal, we have Shih Tzus. You know, we wouldn't, if in Tennessee, we wouldn't win an election if we put our Shih Tzus in a governor commercial. So. It was interesting. And then, of course, I mean, and I guess maybe to people like us, we've worked in politics. We've, of course, worked in media. You know, the discussions between the people filming the commercial and scheming the commercial and then being in the commercial, it was just fascinating to me to see, you know, how Inman portrayed that, because we've been on both sides of that. I mean,
we filmed a campaign commercial for you, if you remember, and we had to select the people in the commercial, and our dog was in the commercial, but it was a poodle.
We've been on both sides of that. Yeah. So that was so interesting because he got it spot on. I mean, as people who've lived through all of that, yeah, it was perfect. So, you know, and so for the person, the average person out there who's never been inside of a campaign, one, you're lucky that that's the case. But two, you know, it was like sort of pulling back the curtain to say, these are the kind of things that people who run campaigns spend hours thinking about. Mm-hmm. That 30-second commercial took, literally, I mean, the dithering about that went on for probably 30 pages, because that's what time it takes to figure this stuff out. So, no, I love that. I love that aspect of it. And then, yeah, at the end, you didn't need to say he lost. You knew he was going to lose, because, you know, there were the storyline part of this was what the current Democratic governor was issuing pardons like they were candy chiclets given out at the fair. This is in the walk up like months away from the election. And it was just a clear thing that you know, the Coles weren't going to win that particular election.
Having not known anything about the book, though, the only thing I'll say is that I thought the whole book could be about the run for the governorship. Like, I didn't know for sure, but, you know, because like you said, the commercial took up so much time and things like that. So to me, it was a little surprising to all of a sudden be like, oh, wait, so now what's going to happen? You know, if we're not talking about the governor's race anymore, where are we shifting? You know, because at that point, the characters had really been completely revolved around that whole running for governor. You didn't really have as much talk about the bank and the fair. I mean, the fair didn't even come up until after that.
Well, the fair was part of the story of governor, but it was sort of a side story. You know, I guess maybe I can identify with that because I'm 47 years old and I still want to what? I mean, what have I done in the last 10 years, Crystal? The last 12 years, I've run for political office. I've helped run a pro wrestling company. I've helped run a baseball team. I'm still technically currently an ESPN baseball and football broadcaster. I mean, I'm a little kid who's still trying to figure out what he wants to do when he grows up. And that's what the Colts were. They were little kids trying to figure out what they want. Do we want to be slick bankers with the biggest building in Knoxville? Can mine be a little bigger? Can we be governor? Can we put on a world's fair in Knoxville and then fly planes and have lunch with the president and then all the affairs they had? I mean, they were big kids still trying to figure it all out. And so, no, I think that, you know, that's that the way to me, the way Inman tells a story is exactly the way those guys seem to live their lives. They were still trying to figure it all out as they were moving along.
So another thing that was really interesting to me about the book, and it took me a little while to catch on, you know, you mentioned that the author, Inman Majors, I think he's a fiction professor at James Madison University here in Harrisonburg. And one of the things that I thought was, one, I think this is one of his earlier books. You know, again, we said he wrote this in 2010. I know he had a book that just came out in May because we have a copy of that too. He's written a series here, it looks like, and I'm just going to show them because this Operation Dimwit is the newest one that we got from New Dominion Bookshop in Charlottesville. And so this is a obviously some kind of a series that he started. Neither of us have read either of these yet, but we have both of them. And I'm not sure that I got it up high enough to actually let you see it there because my camera is actually pretty high. But anyway, I know he's got a couple of other books. We have Swimming in the Sky, Wonder Dog. You mentioned Love's Winning Plays, so we kind of have them all here. But I think this was one of his earlier books, perhaps. And one of the things I thought was that he was, in a way, went out of his way to be very creative in this book. And what I mean is he took some style choices in this book that are a little unusual. And so I'll mention a couple of those, and I just want to get your opinion on that. One of the things that threw me off initially was that Inman doesn't use quotation marks throughout this book. And so one of the things is there's a ton of dialogue in this book. And I know when I first started reading this, I think I got a chapter or two in and then I took a little time off. So I ended up going back and starting again. And it did leave me sometimes wondering without quotation marks, because again, we're so rigid in what we, you know, what we read and what we expect and that kind of thing. And so it was very unexpected because you're like, is he saying this out loud? Is he thinking this? You know, that kind of thing. As a writer yourself, you know, what did you think of the editorial choice to not use quotation marks throughout the whole book?
Well, this is not just this book, I will say. I've read Love's Winning Plays, and I've started, what was the book?
Swimming in the Sky.
Swimming in the Sky. That was actually I assume his first book was written in 2000. So.
Oh, okay.
So the style is similar. Actually, you know, I guess I you know, in college, like you were a communications major, Crystal, in college. I was an American government major, so neither of us are English literature people. But after college, when I was starting as a writer, I gave myself a crash course in literature, if you can say. I just picked out some favorite authors and decided to read them all. And I got into Southern literature for there was one spell, several months where everything I was read was Southern literature. And I'm thinking, now there was one nonfiction author, James Agee, that comes to mind, a few books of his I read, but really from a fiction standpoint, there are echoes of Faulkner, William Faulkner, great Southern author who also taught at the University of Virginia for a long time. And Faulkner is just a heavyweight legend in literature, and particularly Southern literature. I catch echoes of Faulkner in Inman's books. And I'm also one, so I'm not one who cares about the rules. In fact, I like breaking the rules all the time in my writing, run-on sentences and short sentences and long sentences and everything else altogether, because it's more about getting the thought out than it is about the style. I think you have to be grounded in the style. And it's interesting that a person who teaches fiction writing like Inman, I'm sure he has to, with his students, go over, make sure, hey, you gotta know the rules. And now you can break the rules if you know the rules. If you don't know the rules, you can't break them. His style is very unique, though, in his sense. I mean, and especially because the Southern authors I mentioned, those are writers from the early 20th century, early to mid 20th century. You don't often see that kind of writing done in the contemporary scene. So it is very, I'm sure it's very different because you read a lot, but I'm sure it's this is the first kind of writing you've read of this nature.
Right. And it seems like most of his books are, well, at least several of his books are, have that Southern flair to them. So they had that. So that was a little interesting, and it did take me a little bit of time to get used to that style. The other thing that was kind of interesting, I thought, and I know you know what I'm going to say before I even say it, was the fact that at some points in the book, the chapter shifted from normal storytelling to more of like a screenplay or a play. What did you think of how he mixed up some of the chapters? When I say like a screenplay, it was actually written like saying what camera angles to give and things of that nature. Do you think that was just kind of a play a little bit more on the inside politics and that kind of thing? Or what are your thoughts about how he was very creative in how he inserted that into the book?
What I liked about those particular chapters was that it was there to give you the scene, and because like you said, Crystal, earlier, that most of his, this is a very dialogue heavy book, even though there's no quotation marks, it's very dialogue driven. Mm-hmm. And so the only outside of dialogue, because there was really no other setting of scenes other than those particular short chapters that were written as, like you said, they it was as if those who have ever read a screenplay or written a screenplay, but have read a screenplay, it very much read that way. I think they were all like TV kind of things. It was almost like if he was writing the screenplay for a movie, this is how you were setting. And so, it was a great change of pace, to a different way of telling a story. And, what the message would be here is that students at JMU have a great creative writing professor at their access there. Now, I know he took this semester off for lots of obvious reasons, but when Inman comes back, I mean, if I had a kid, I'd be saying, if we had a kid, Crystal, and our kid, of course, I mean, that poor, unfortunate soul would be expected to be a writer. I would make sure that Inman was teaching them, because very creative presentation of how to get a story across.
So, we were talking a little bit about Teague in the end, and about how at the end of the book, they were really kind of moving money between banks, doing some things, obviously, that were illegal, forging some signatures, things like that. Were you surprised in the end that Teague was so loyal to the Cole brothers, like that he wouldn't give either of the bureaus of investigation any information, anything that he might have, even if it saved himself?
I'm not sure if it was loyalty to the Cole brothers, though. That's the only contention.
And what was it?
He was being loyal to himself. He even said at one point, I'm not quoting him directly, obviously, but he got to there was a scene late in the book where he met with was JT the one that survived? I lost the detail there.
Roland was the one.
Okay, thank you. I had a 50%. Roland.
And that's a spoiler alert that.
Don't say.
Okay, all right.
He had the meeting with Roland, I don't think he said it outright, but he said everything but outright that his business as a lobbyist. He mentioned this in his one of his meetings with the then current governor too. That his advice as a lobbyist and as a campaign manager type, because he played all those roles, The only value was the confidentiality that he offered to his clients. And that the moment he would renege on his confidentiality, because especially in the meeting with the governor, when the governor says that he won't help him, not that he can't help him, that he won't help him through his potential legal quagmire, all you got to do is tell the TBI what you know about the Coles and you're going to be free, because look at all the facts of the case. They're not looking for you. They're looking for the Coles. And he said this, so otherwise you're going to go to prison for a few years. And he said, if I give information on the Coles, one, I've got to give information on you too, because I know a lot about you. And he said, I'm not threatening you, but basically if I start telling stories, I got to tell stories for a long time. And then I'm never going to be doing what I'm doing ever again. And so that's why I don't think he was being loyal to the Coles. He was being loyal to himself, because he felt like if he started telling stories on other people, and I don't say telling, he starts even telling the truth on other people, but he starts telling what he knows on other people, he will never work in Tennessee politics again. And he wanted to have some way, he wanted to have some way to be able to continue working in Tennessee politics. And that was the only way he could do so.
After the betrayal by the Cole brothers towards Teague, after Teague was basically the charges against him were eventually dismissed because Roland basically said, look, he didn't have anything to do with it and came clean about the forgeries and things of that nature. Roland at the end of the book actually met with Teague, and he called Teague and asked to meet him at a diner just to chat a little bit. Were you surprised that Teague was willing to meet with him after the ringer that Teague and his family had been put through with the FBI and the TBI and the investigations?
Okay, so I got to think. I got to think as a person reading and not the writer, because the writer needs them to meet. I mean, just to be able to have the clearing of the air from the writer's perspective, you need to create that scene where they get to kind of have their goodbyes, right? So from that perspective, the writer needs to create. I'm trying to think now how to justify that Teague would want to meet with him. It was tenuous how you would get them to meet, because, Teague owed nothing to them. Maybe the way you could justify that would be to say that Teague wanted the Coles to know that he owed them nothing, and that he had no hard feelings. I think what the thrust of that was is that it's not personal, it's politics. The meeting with that then current governor and Teague, it's not personal, it's politics. If I help you out in this case, then I'm making it personal. And look, I'm a Republican. You guys are Democrats. We've got to hate each other. So no, that's the way I would justify that. But again, I was thinking more as the writer at that stage, you've got to have them meet just so that you can have that come to Jesus moment between the two.
The book is based on, as we said, the Knoxville World Fair based in Tennessee. Not knowing that, though, and just reading this as pure fiction, so to speak, one of the things that kind of that crossed my mind is, if let's say that the Cole brothers had not been investigated or were not under the inspector's eye, so to speak, so early, right after the World's Fair. If they had been given 6 months or a year or some period of time after that, could they have gotten their ducks in a row? Like, what might have been a different fate for them? When you were reading, Chris, this, and obviously that's not what happened, but it could have taken a very different turn had they had just a little bit more time to work things out. I guess I'm just curious about what you think about that. I mean, this book could have taken so many different turns if Roland had won the governorship, or if they had just had that extra bit of time at the end, perhaps JT wouldn't have gone out on the day that he did, on a flight, just to kind of clear the air, so to speak. A lot of things could have happened very differently. Do you think that they were destined for this fate? And again, it's based on real stuff, so it's hard to have that conversation, but let's say they had gotten through this. Do you think there just would have been a next thing? I mean, do you think that they would have kind of had the same fate? They would have continued to push things to the very edge, to the point where they were eventually put behind bars, so to speak.
Not knowing much about the real life guys this is based on, but assuming that Inman, who does know that story very well, did not overstate how on the edge these guys were. No, they were not going to just have things work out and live happily ever after. They didn't come across as that way. If the thing would be people who built a small town thrift into a Knox. I just looked up Knoxville's population. I don't know what it was in 1980, but in 2020, it's 191,000. So me saying it's Charlottesville, Charles was 45,000. This is 191,000 is about the size of Richmond. Okay. So, if you go from being a small town bank, big player to being a big city bank, big player, and then you put on a World's Fair, you run for governor. It doesn't matter. You lose running for governor. You run for governor. They were putting the feelers out to run for governor again. So
I was going to say too, like, even though they knew that they were forging all these signatures and doing all these things with their bank, at the very end, Roland sent Teague, back to find out, to float his name as possibly running for governor again. And this was in the midst of the investigation.
A year after losing, apparently historically bad election. Yeah. I mean, so, they were, if they would have, if their chicanery had worked, and nobody had known that they had propped up, themselves to be able to put this World's Fair on, that would have only emboldened them to do even bigger, stupider things, I think. I mean, honestly. And so, I don't fault them for that, honestly. I mean, to some degree, you can a lot of people live their lives very comfortably. I mean, we're among them. We're comfortable. Life's great.
We're comfortable, but we're not holding lavish affairs like they did by a pool that they couldn't afford to do at the time.
The reason I say that is because comfortable is there's a value in comfort. They decided that, we don't want to be comfortable. We want to go for the gusto. They wanted the brass ring. It takes a certain chutzpah to run for governor. It takes a certain amount of something in your loins to say, we're going to put a World's Fair on in a relatively 191,000 is a big city for people like us, but New York's 10 million. I mean, so it's small potatoes to that. It takes a certain something to make you do those kind of things in life. Once you've tasted it, you're not going to go back to comfortable. So no, they would have continued pushing the envelope, and they would have just eventually, there would have just been a really big, really spectacular failure, as if this wasn't already one itself.
Okay, so I have one more question, and then I just want to get some personal insight from you as well. What did you think of the title of the book, The Millionaires? And I say that because, of course, we don't really know if the Cole brothers were truly millionaires. As they said, they learned very early on that to be successful, they had to borrow, and they continued borrowing and borrowing and borrowing to grow their empire, so to speak. And certainly from the outside, people who looked at their mansion, there along the, I think it was along a river, there in Tennessee, they might say, okay, yeah, that looks like, that looks to me like it's a $1 million house or, that kind of thing. But a lot of it was appearances, as you would say. What did you think of the title, The Millionaires? I almost felt like there should be a question mark at the end of that, Millionaires.
Is our current president a billionaire, really? I mean, and when you start really breaking it down, is anybody a millionaire or a billionaire? I mean, everything whatever wealth people accumulate is based on, I mean, to some degree, other people's work and labor that you've been able to manipulate and conjure and put in your own bank account. So, and maybe that's part of the message here. I don't know. I'd love to ask Inman that question as far as that. But, so the one of the you mentioned that the Tuscaloosa News is who it was that called this a kind of a Southern Great Gatsby. When you put it in those terms, I mean, think about the Great Gatsby. We all read that book in high school, right? Gatsby was the original put on appearances and make yourself look better than you are kind of thing. I think it's totally appropriate. It's what they thought of themselves as, the Cole brothers, that is the real life Butcher brothers. They thought of themselves that way. They were East Tennessee State guys who struck it rich. And yeah, of course, they use other people's money to do it, whatever. To some degree, everybody does. So who becomes wealthy in that way? So plus to me, I mean, just the imagery, like the cover. You don't judge a book by its cover, but look at his cover. I mean, look at the font, the image, you know, in picture, whatever that might be. Mm-hmm. You know, it really stands out. Like, wow, I mean, these guys, look at them. Look at the people. They throw parties, like the parties described in this thing. They've got to be somebody. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's the art of it is part of the game.
So stepping back, just as we prepare to wrap up here, we usually try to keep these to about an hour. My question for you is this, Chris. You've met Inman, as you talked about. His daughter interned with us. And, you know, I remember that Inman showed up at our door one time with a copy of his book, you know, when we lived at the top of the hill on Main Street in Waynesboro. I still remember that. And I know that you've kept in touch with him over the years through email and through other things.
It was this book that he handled.
It was this book that he dropped off. Okay, great. Well, so, I mean, I know that you've kind of kept in touch with him over the years. I'm just curious, like, what you know about him, like, as the author. You know what I mean? I mean, we all know he's the JMU professor and that kind of thing, but just any conversations he might have had with you kind of outside of this. I know you've written stories about him for our print magazine and some other things, but just, I'm just curious if you have any insight that we wouldn't get from the book, you know, about the author Inman Majors. As I said, he's got a number of books that you can read. New Dominion Bookshop has his latest book, the Operation Dimwit, which is part of a series that he's written here as well. He's not doing any book tours or anything specific for that, but definitely encourage people who want to read him to check out the series. I know I got both of them. The first one in the series, it looks like, might be this Game On copy. But anyway, I'm just curious about the man that you know, Chris, and anything that you might want to add in reference to that, you know, outside of what we know about his writing and his books.
I'd like to say I know that we've had discussions about writing, but we never really did. And I hate to say that, and which means I need to put on my life checklist, have discussions about writing with Inman Majors. But I think what you can see out of him, one, he, from having read his other books, the one I've read incomplete and the other one I'm about a third of the way through, he's got a great attention to detail, which of course is an important skill for any author. Because you know, he can really describe, and I think this is unique to Southern authors. I mean, I'm a big fan of Southern literature. And you know, there are very distinct things about Southern literature. One is that the belaboring the point about telling setting a certain scene. Mm-hmm. Colorful language, many more words to describe an idiom than are needed, I think. But we're good at that in the South, you know. We have more time, maybe. Life is more languorous down here. Inman is, to me, what am I searching for here? He is someone who, in my opinion, should be a nationally, internationally known author. I'm not just saying it because I know the guy and really respect the guy and got to really, really love his daughter because she was such a great light the time we got to know her. He, as a writer, he really is. He's really that good. Maybe I'm biased because I like politics, good politics writing and good sports-themed fiction writing. And because to me, there are so many stories behind the scenes in both those lives that I've seen, I guess, because I've worked in both realms for 25 years. Inman does a great job telling stories. And, I can only imagine what he's like as a professor. I would love, maybe I think I could learn a lot from sitting in a class of his, certainly, or taking a class of his for a whole semester. But what I can really say is what he was able to impart, and at least he has two children. Max survives. Tess, when he first reached out to us, this is June of 2020. It was probably the fall of 2018 when he reached out to say, hey, I'm thinking about, you know, asking if it's okay if Tess, my daughter, does an internship with you guys. You know, we do internships generally every spring. We didn't do one this spring for lots of obvious reasons. This spring was a weird spring health-wise, public health-wise. But for a number of years, we've had a spring intern. So that'd be great. We don't have one lined up now. Let's do it. Usually we have college kids. A couple times we've had high school kids, usually we have college kids. So I'm thinking already, man, okay, now I got a high school kid. I'm going to have to do some more hands-on stuff here. So she reaches out to me, Tess reaches out to me in December of 2018, I guess it was. She wants to meet. And I'm thinking, well, gosh, maybe that internship is going to be a whole semester because she's reaching out in December. And she meets and she has all these, you know, all these things in a notebook written out. And she wants to go over them all with me. And she has all these great ideas for stories she wants to work on. And just energetic, very thoughtful, very well thought out young lady. And so I'm ready to go. And she says, oh, the internship doesn't start until April. Wow. You are on target here. You know, this kid's going to be an interesting kid to have around. So maybe one of the nicer things I can say about him, I mean, I love his book. So I can't say enough about how well-written, entertaining his books are. But maybe the nice thing I can say about him and, of course, his wife, Christy, is that they raised a daughter who, wow, I mean, she could have turned pro right after high school and gone into journalism and done a great job and done a better job than most people who currently get paid a lot of money to do that work. I didn't know that she was a musician. She mentioned that she played in a band. Okay, I wanted to say this. She mentioned while doing the internship, she played in a band. And I thought, okay, so every other high school kid is also playing in a band. So, you know, whatever. And I said, send me your music one day. I'll listen to it. So finally get an email from her in November, midway through, or I guess towards the end of her first semester at Barnard. I got our band. We're online now. Here's the link to my music. By the way, and she says, dear Mr. Graham, you know, like, well, I'm not Mr. Graham. That's somebody's dad. That's not me. And then she says, you might not remember me. I'm Tess. Like, how could we forget you, Tess? Okay. And she says all this, and what a polite young lady. I hate to admit, I didn't listen to the music until the day that you got the note that said that she'd been murdered. And we've listened to it a lot since. And I've communicated with Inman a lot. You and I have both communicated with Inman a lot the last few months. And I communicate with him to say, that one of her songs came up on my playlist the other day, and that it was her song Prom Queen. And I said, Inman, I got to tell you, you know, your book, The Millionaires, is one of the best books I've ever read, but it doesn't hold a candle to Prom Queen. It made his day that I said that. I think one of the better things I can say is that the DNA pool has great writing in it. And that he was able to pass some of that on to his daughter.
You know, and I can't think of a better way to end, except that I did want to add that we went to Tess's funeral, her remembrance ceremony at St. Anne's Belfield. And one of the things that I would say about that is you could tell what a creative family they had and what a inspiring family and what wonderful parents that Inman and Christy were to Tess. And I say that because from everything, from the program that was handed out and the neat little stories and stories that Tess probably would have been embarrassed for them to tell about, you know, her, I think it was a buddy, and, you know, they were beautifully told little snapshots of life, and, you know, the photos that were displayed, and the fact that the service there, it wasn't really about preaching. It was about remembering her. There were so her teacher at St. Anne's Belfield spoke so well, about her, but also the fact that they included so much music from her friends. You know, Tess Bryan, who was her best friend and happens to live here in Waynesboro, a couple blocks up the street from us here, actually performed Prom Queen and was remarkable in that role. And I know that Inman and Christy had a number of these young musicians who were distraught at their home, trying to come up with the playlist for the service, so to speak. And, you know, just the fact that they allow this remembrance ceremony to truly be about her daughter and her friends and to include them in such a big way. We've all been to so many funerals that are so impersonal, you know, that it could have been a funeral for anyone. And this service was not. This service was about Tess and her family and her friends. And I think that that speaks great volumes to the kind of parents that Christy and Inman are. And of course, that that creativity, that that inspiration that he gave her, you know, it comes out in his books. You know, I'm so glad. I know why you picked this book. And I know in large part you wanted to pick one of Inman's books just because, you know, just to give him a little boost in a tough time, you know. And I'm so glad. I know you picked it because of politics. I know how much you have a passion for politics and also for, you know, kind of the Southern style of books too, and the style of writing. It definitely did introduce me to something a little bit different, something that while I've been thrown into politics, good and bad, you know, the style of writing for me was very different. And yet I loved this book. I appreciated the fact that there were really like three stories about these characters within this, you know. I'm one of those people who always roots for the characters in the books though. And, you know, so the only thing I could say that was sad was that, you know, me being the Pollyanna type person that I am, you know, would have loved for JT and Roland to have found a way out of this, you know, somehow squirmed their way out and went on. But I know that you had to bring closure, and especially knowing now that it was based on real life events, that played a part in it as well.
Let me break some bad news to you. If Southern literature, there's never a happy ending.
Maybe that's why I don't read it. Maybe that's not why it's normally on my list. But but I am going to read a couple more of Inman's books. Most of them don't appear to be quite as long as this one was. This was a nice thick read, and it was a good read for the springtime, so to speak. So I appreciate you suggesting this title, Chris. I don't know how you could wrap it up any more beautifully than you just did. So I think we'll go ahead and close for the evening. So definitely want to encourage you to read The Millionaires. Because it is 10 years old, it is a little more challenging to find. I found it through a used bookstore, and I think it's on some of those Audible type things where you can listen to it as well. But definitely encourage you to do your part and find this book. And if not this book for whatever reason, you know, like I said, the New Dominion Bookshop does have a couple of his more recent titles, so I encourage you to check those out
I love winning plays. I would highly recommend. It dives into football, but it's a story. It's a well written story. I would recommend it highly. And
I love the cover of that book too. You know, you always say a cover, you know, doesn't sell a book, but I loved the cover of Love's Winning
Play. Well, actually, they do say a cover sells a book. It shouldn't sell a book, but it actually does. No, it's a good book, and the book I'm into now, The Swimming with the Sky, is one that I'm already very, very interested in as well. So, now, so you know, and plus, it's again someone who lives in your backyard, you know, you can say you knew him when, because you know, at some point soon, Inman's going to take off, we're all going to be able to say that we were there when it happened. So.
All right. So just to the Majors family, you know, we continue to think of you all, you know, especially with the loss of, you know, of your family member today, and also with the continuing court cases, you know, and all that's happening in the news, and just for your loss of Tess, because I know how awful that must be for your family.
We only knew her for 6 weeks, and it's still hard when we hear a song come up on our playlist and hear her voice. It's still hard for us, and we only knew her for 6 weeks, so I can only imagine how hard it is for you guys.
So on behalf of Augusta Free Press, thanks for tuning in to our book club, our virtual book club this evening. We launched these book club series in large part due to the fact that many of us were indoors due to COVID-19. As we're starting to get some loosening of restrictions in Virginia, we'll look toward the future and see if we're going to add a couple more of these down the road as well. But in the meantime, we hope you enjoyed the two that we did host this summer. Hopefully it gave you something to do. Appreciate Rod Mullins for weighing in a little bit this evening on the topic as well. And keep reading. There's a lot of great books. Chris and I picked up quite a few recently. You mentioned John Grisham. He just had a new book out that we got a signed copy of from New Dominion Bookshop as well. So support your local booksellers when you can. And thanks for tuning in to our virtual book club. I hope you all have a great night.